The Cloudbursters by Francis Lind. It was an article in the news columns of the Brewster Morning Tribune which first called attention, the attention of the Brewsterites and the Intermountain world in general, to the plans and purposes of the Mesquite Valley Land and Irrigation Company. Connor Bell, a hard-working reporter on the Tribune, had been sent over to Angels, the old headquarters of the Red Butte Western on the other side of the Timanionis, to get the story of a shooting affray which had localized itself in Peter Grimm's place, the one remaining angelic saloon. Finding the barroom battle of little worth as a news story and having time to kill between trains, Connabell had strolled off up the gulch beyond the old copper mines and had stumbled upon the construction camp of the Mesquite Company. Being short of copy on the fight story, the reporter had written up the irrigation project, taking the general outlines from a foreman on the job whose tongue he loosened with a handful of Brewster cigars. A big earth dam was in process of construction across the mouth of the rather precipitous valley of Mesquite Creek, and the mesa below, which to Connabell's unrural eye seemed to be a very Sahara of infertile desolation, was to be made to blossom like the rose. Kendall, managing editor of the Tribune, had run the story, partly because real news happened to be scarce at the moment, and partly out of sheer astonishment that an enterprise of the magnitude of the Mesquite project had not already flooded the country with the brass band publicity literature which is supposed to attract investors. That a land and irrigation company should actually wait until its dam was three-fourths completed before it began to advertise was a thing sufficiently curious to call for editorial comment. Why Editor Kendall did not comment on the news item as a matter of singular interest is a query which had its answer on the loggia porch of the Hotel Topaz in the evening of the day on which Connabell's write-up appeared. It was Kendall's regular habit to close his desk at 7 o'clock and to spend a leisurely hour over his dinner at the Topaz before settling down to his night's work. On the evening in question, he chanced to sit at table with Maxwell, the general superintendent of the railroad, and with Maxwell's friend and college classmate, Sprague. After dinner, the three had gone out to the loggia porch to smoke, and it was the big chemistry expert who spoke of the Mesquite news story which had appeared that morning in the Tribune. "Yes," said the editor. "Connabell got on to that yesterday. I sent him over to Angels to write up a shooting scrape, and he had more time on his hands than he knew what to do with. Ah, we've all known in a general way that an eastern company was doing something over there. But I had no idea that they'd got their dam pretty nearly done and were about ready to open up for business." "It's wildcat, pure and unadulterated," cut in the railroad man snappily. "What they're gonna do to a lot of woolly investors will be good and plenty. That Mesquite Mesa land is just about as fertile as this street pavement here." Kendall was a dried-up little wisp of a man with tired eyes and a face the color of old oak-tanned leather. "Yeah, that's what you think, that they're out there for the easy money," he agreed, "but there is something a little queer about it. They haven't advertised." "Not here," supplemented Maxwell. "That would be a trifle too rank. Everybody in the Timanione knows what that land is over in the edge of the Red Desert." "They haven't advertised anywhere, so far as I can ascertain," put in the editor quietly. "What's more, Jennings, who was the engineer in charge of the dam building and who seems to be the only man in authority on the ground, came in this afternoon and raised hand with me for printing the news story. He said they were not exploiting the scheme here at all, that their money and their investors were all in the East, and they were asking no odds of the Brewster newspapers. Bitter sort of devil, that fellow Jennings," was Maxwell's comment. But it was the big chemist who followed the main thread of the argument. "What reason did he give for making such an extraordinary break as that, Mr. Kendall?" "Oh, he had his reason pat enough," rejoined the editor with his tired smile. "He said he realized that we have irrigated land of our own over here in the park upon which we are anxious to get settlers, and that public sentiment here would naturally be against the Mesquite project. He asked, as a matter of fairness, that we simply let the desert project alone. He claimed that it had been financed without taking a dollar out of the Timanione, so we could not urge that there were local investors to be protected." That argument cuts both ways. It's an admission that the Eastern investors might need protection, scoffed the railroad superintendent. Then he added, they certainly will if they expect to get any of the money back that they've been spending in Mesquite Valley. Why, Kendall, Mesquite Creek is bone dry half the year. And the other half? Inquired Sprague. It's a cloudburst proposition, like a good many of the foothill arroyos, Maxwell explained. Once, in a summer storm, I saw a wall of water 10 feet high come down that stream bed, tumbling 20-ton boulders in the thick of it as if they'd been brook pebbles. Then for a month, maybe, it'd be merely a streak of dry sand. Perhaps they are counting upon storing the cloudburst water, commented Kendall dryly. Then as he rose to go back to his work, as you say, Maxwell, it has all the earmarks of the wildcat, but so long as it doesn't stick its claws out at us, I suppose we haven't much excuse for butting in. Good night, gentlemen. Drop in on me when you're up my way. Always glad to see you. The two who remained on the hotel porch after the editor went away smoked a comradely silence for a time. The night was enchantingly fine, with the first quarter moon swinging low in a vault of velvety blackness, and a gentle breeze, fragrant with the breath of the mountain forests, creeping down upon the city from the backgrounding highlands. Across the plaza, and somewhere in the yards behind the long two-storied railroad headquarters building and station, a night crew was making up trains, and the clank and crash of coupling cars mingled with the rapid-fire exhausts of the switching engine. The big-bodied chemistry expert was the first to break the companionable silence, asking a question which had reference to the epidemic of disaster and demoralization which had recently swept over Maxwell's railroad. Well, how are things coming by this time, Dick? Are the men responding fairly well to that little circular letter, man-to-man appeal we concocted? They are, for a fact, was the hearty assurance. I've never seen anything like it in railroading in all my knocking about. They've been coming in squads to fess up and take the pledge. That'll assure me that it's the water wagons of theirs from now on. By George, Calvin, it's the most mellowing experience I've ever had. It proves what you've always said. And what I've always wanted to believe, that the good in the mass definitely outweighs the bad, and that it will come to the front if you only know how to appeal to it. That's right, averred the chemist. It is the strong hope of the country that there is justice and fairness and sane common sense at the American bottom of us, if you can only get at it. I think you can call the booze fight and demoralization roundup a troubled past, and begin to look around you for the signs and symptoms of the next biff you're going to get. The stockily built little man who stood as the railroad company's chief field officer on the far western fighting line moved uneasily in his chair. I've been hoping there wasn't going to be any next time, he said, chewing thoughtfully upon his cigar. I should hope with you, Dick, if we'd been able in any of the former scrimmages to secure good, indubitable court evidence against the men who were backing these buccaneering raids on your securities. The one thing big money really fears today is the law. The law is the federal courts are likely to construe and administer it, but to obtain your day in court, you've got to have evidence. And thus far, we haven't been able to sweat out anything that would implicate the man or men higher up. Therefore, you may continue to sleep on your arms, keeping a sharp eye out for surprises. I guess that's pretty good advice, was the ready admission. But it is rather difficult to put into practice, Calvin. There are 500 miles of this railroad, and my job of operating them is big enough to keep me busy without doing any detective stunts on the side. I know, Sprague nodded reflectively. And for that reason, I've been halfway keeping an eye out for you myself. You have? Don't tell me you've been finding more grief. Sprague threw away his outburned stub and found and lighted a fresh cigar. I don't want to pose as an alarmist, he offered at length, but I'd like to dig a little deeper into this Mesquite irrigation scheme. How much or how little do you know about it? Next to nothing. About 2 months ago, Jennings, the construction engineer, made application for the through handling from COPA of a trainload of machinery and tools and camp outfit. He has to have the stuff delivered to the end of the old copper mine spur above Angels. We put the spur in shape for him. and delivered the freight. Well, what else? Well, that's about all we've had to do with them in a business way. 2 weeks ago, when we had that wreck at Lobo, they were asking Benson for an extension of the copper mine spur to a point nearer their job, chiefly, I think, so they could run a hand car back and forth between the camp and the saloon at Angel's. Benson didn't recommend it, and the matter was dropped. Without protest. Oh, yes. Jennings didn't make much of a roar. In fact, I've always felt that he avoided me when he could. He's in town a good bit, but I rarely see him. Somebody told me he tried once to get into the Town and Country Club and didn't make it. I don't know who would blackball him or why, but evidently someone did. The ash grew a full half-inch longer on Sprague's fresh cigar before he said, "Doesn't it occur to you that there is something a bit mysterious about this dry land irrigation scheme, Dick?" "I had never thought of it as being mysterious. It's a palpable swindle, of course, but swindles are like the poor. They're always with us." "It interests me," said the big man half amusingly. "A company formed nobody knows where or how drops down in the edge of the Red Desert and begins absolutely without any of the clatter and clamor of advertising that usually go with such enterprises to build what, from all reports, must be a pretty costly dam. If they've acquired a title to the Mesquite Mesa, no one seems to have heard of it, and if they're hoping to sell the land when the dam is completed, that too had been kept dark. Now comes this little newspaper puff this morning, and Mr. Jennings promptly turns up to ask Kendall to drop it." "That is rather queer, when you come to put the odds and ends of it together," admitted the railroad man. "Decidedly queer, I should say." So far the government man went on the line which he himself had opened. Then he switched abruptly. "By the way, where's your brother-in-law, Starbuck? I haven't seen him for 3 or 4 days. "Billy's been in Red Butte, figuring on a little mining deal in which we're both interested in. But I'm looking for him back tonight." "Good. If you should happen to see him when the train comes in, ask him to come over here and smoke a pipe with me. Tell him I'm losing my carefully acquired cowboy accent and I'd like to freshen up a bit." The superintendent promised, and since he always had work to do, went across to his office in the second story of the combined headquarters and station building.